Hello. In recent audio snippets, we have been talking about race, and in the context of race, we've also taken a detour to talk a little bit about gender. And we'd like to mention something that we might have mentioned in passing before or not mentioned at all, but if we have mentioned it, it's worth expanding on it a little more. And it's related to gender and the fact that gender and sexual tendencies are not a valid, the sexual tendencies themselves are not a valid or are reliable way of defining a person's identity because of how fluctuating they can be, how subject to change. If you have, for example, a piece of gold, gold can have can be in several states. It could be in a liquid state if it's if someone has melted it, or it can have impurities in it and so forth. But gold remains gold. And you know gold is gold because of its atomic number, how many protons are in the nucleus of those molecules. And you can have a lot of factors that vary around gold, but that one factor will never change. And if it doesn't have the exact number of protons that you expect in a gold atom, then it's not gold. No matter how you paint it, if it looks gold on the outside, if it does not have that number of atoms of protons in its nucleus, then it's not gold. So the number of protons defines the gold molecule's identity, and that does not change. So if you have something that can fluctuate and can be moved and sway to and fro from one end to the other, then you're not talking about identity, about something that is inherent and fundamental. And then to base your life on that as being your identity is to build a house on a sandy foundation. And one of the ways that we can once again see how unreliable that concept is of that liberals do of associating identity with sexual tendencies is the biological fact that, as many of you may know, that all men, and I mean not biological men, have some estrogen, and all women, all biological women, have some testosterone. And as you know, testosterone is the hormone that is most common in men, and estrogen, the one that's most common in women. But even so, men have some estrogen, some of the female hormones inside of them, and women have some male hormones, male testosterone hormones in them. So it's not as if men have just one type of hormone and women have just one another type, completely different type, that they are separate. And so the question would be why is it like that? Why do men have some feminine hormones in them, and why do women have some masculine hormones in them? And I believe that part of the purpose in that is to enable a level of awareness in one gender of what is pleasing to the other. And that has a role to play in sexuality, in human sexuality, where one gender needs to kind of understand what pleases the other gender, and that improves the, you could say, the sexual dynamic. And so it's a necessary component of the human experience, you could say, for men to have a feminine component in them. In this case, and I'm speaking biologically, and the same thing for women. And the problem is that because we have this combination inside each gender, that creates the possibility of confusion about what a person may feel. For example, if a man sees another man and the man is physically attractive, the man can perceive that in some measure, and because of the estrogen in him, he can in a way perceive how a woman would perceive that man. And I believe that part of the purpose of that is so that men can kind of have an understanding of what to strive towards to please women, and the same thing with women and men. And so if you have a person, a young person, who sees a young man, who sees another man, and recognizes certain features that are attractive, and recognizes a certain sexual attractiveness in that other man, if that young kid is being told, on the other hand, at school, as it's happening now at the time of this recording in America, that homosexuality is okay, and that it's a normal thing, and that and if you have feelings like that, you have to let them develop because that's who you are, because they, you know, they tie that identity to sexual tendencies, then the kid, because he doesn't understand that what he's perceiving is the result of the estrogen in him that is there for a purpose, then he can start thinking, oh, I am a homosexual, and then start leaning towards that. And the thing is, the moment your mind starts making a decision, I am, you know, this, then that creates a change in the brain and in the body, and it starts creating a tendency that would not normally be there because it was abnormally introduced by a foreign concept that misinterpreted something that was happening in a natural way for a different purpose than what the idea is saying it's about. So in other words, that feeling that young man may have had at seeing another man and seeing the attractiveness in the man, that idea comes and tells him that means he's a homosexual when he's not a homosexual. But because he perceived that, now the idea comes and influences him into thinking that he's a homosexual, then he's going to start cultivating that idea. And if that is combined with certain parameters that make homosexuality more plausible in certain people than in others, then slowly that kid starts growing up with a homosexual tendency. And as we also said before, if a kid has been abused, sodomized and abused as a kid, that may teach him that that's the normal way of having pleasure in his life, and then he starts then he grows up a homosexual, because it's like he was kind of forced or jammed into that tendency, and the brain starts gearing towards that because. We can learn many things and turn them into almost natural things if we force ourselves enough to embrace them. For example, take smoking. Smoking is very unnatural. And obviously every time a person takes a cigarette for the first time, you know, they cough, and it's a very unpleasant experience. But they must force their body to embrace the smoking, and eventually the body gets trained into it, and it becomes hooked to the smoking. And that does not mean that you were born a smoker or that your identity is as a smoker, and if they take the cigarettes away from you, then they're denying you your identity. And that's more or less a figure of what happens when the liberals start telling young kids that if someone tries to take away your right, quote unquote, to be homosexual, then they are taking away your identity. it's the same thing as someone saying, if you take away my cigarettes, then you are taking away my identity. It's that that's a cigarette example is one of the many manifestations in life of how our brain can adapt to liking something that it normally would not like. And the same thing happens with sexual tendencies. That's why, as we said before, people end up getting into sadomasochism and other very nasty things that are totally unnatural. And they start deriving pleasure from, some people, like rapists, they derive pleasure from torturing women and seeing them in fear. That is completely abnormal and unnatural, but they have trained their brains into embracing that somehow, and that becomes the normal thing. But that it's not part of their identity. It's part of their behavioral decisions, and also the influence of circumstances around him. And as we've always said, it's an idea that gets planted into a person's heart and mind, and it then starts developing into something that it shouldn't be. So so you may know, regarding estrogen and testosterone, I read recently that excessive estrogen in men can lead to cancer or diabetes. In other words, yes, man can have a certain level of estrogen, but if for some biological or medical reason the man starts having excessive levels of estrogen, that can be harmful to him physically. And can lead to cancer, diabetes, and other issues. And by the same token, excessive testosterone in women can be a sign of cancer in the ovaries, for example. In other words, excess testosterone can be a sign that something is not right in the woman's anatomy. So that means that when we try to artificially change a man into a woman, we are basically altering something physically that is not natural, that and not natural in the sense of something that will kill you or that will do you harm, because it's the body is not designed for that. It's said that sometimes when women have low levels of testosterone, because they can have they already have naturally low levels of testosterone, but if they go even lower, that can be triggered by certain peculiar factors such as depression. It can also be triggered by relationship issues and by impotence in their male partner. And I mentioned this right now because that's just another example of how our sexual tendencies can be affected by things that have nothing to do with, quote, who we are. In other words, a woman can have lower levels of testosterone because of psychological things that are happening in her life, depression, relationship issues, problems with their partner. Or friends or whatever, but mostly partners, and a sexual impotence in their male partners can trigger them having their hormone levels of testosterone go down. So that shows how when someone feels like a man or feels like a woman or whatever, that can be can go up or down depending on things that have nothing to do with the person's identity, with psychological or circumstantial issues or factors. So this is all just to emphasize the fluidity of sexual tendencies and how it is incorrect to tie identity to them. They are just behavioral tendencies. That's what they are. We wanted to mention that. And regarding the issue of that sexual fluidity or gender fluidity that liberals, especially white liberals, constantly emphasize, it's important to mention, and we said this before, but we want to say it again, that sexualizing children the way liberals are right now at the time of this recording is a violation of their right to privacy. And we spoke at length about what that's all about, what that means in previous audio clips. But the right to privacy is, the in a way, the right to have your own space where you can be, quote, naked. And I mean that literally or figuratively, where you can kind of uncover yourself and be vulnerable and in a way that would be shameful to you in public. And children don't have a level of privacy developed. That's why they, you know, very little young kids don't have a problem with nakedness. They don't have that concept yet. The concept of privacy in them is not developed. And so that's why also as young kids, their level of privacy is much, their right to privacy in a way is much lower than the right to privacy of an adult. But having said that, when an adult, let's say, gets naked in front of a kid, even though the kid has no concept of that, that is him trying to intrude, you know, in a natural way into the privacy of the kid. And that happens even if it's not a kid. You know, if there's someone outside walking around naked, that person is kind of claiming the entire street as a private area. And it's, in a sense, forcing everyone who is outside to enter into that person's private space, even if they don't want to. So that's an example of when one extends one's own private zone and intrudes onto the, you know, kind of forces other people into their, into that private zone, even when those people don't want to be there. So in a sense, it's a violation of their privacy by you extending your own zone of privacy. And when you start feeding sexual concepts into a kid who doesn't understand them or doesn't care for them because he or she is not in that age, what you're doing is you're intruding on their privacy, even if they already have a very low level of privacy. You're intruding on it, and the problem is that when you do it, you are kind of plastering thoughts into them that then, when they grow up, become a source of violation. It's as if you are entering into their private zone. You're leaving an imprint that doesn't go away. And then when they grow up and then they have an awareness of their own nakedness, their own need for privacy, that violation that happened years earlier when they didn't understand it that well becomes a problem. It's like a permanent a kind of branding that happens on that kid's heart and mind. And then that kid is branded for life as having had a permanent violation of his or her privacy. So when you start doing these horrible things of teaching sexual concepts to kids who just should be free to be kids and play with dolls and G.I. Joes or whatever kids do and play with their toy cars and run around in the mud and chase seagulls or whatever they want to do, you know, when you take away that innocence and start and putting all these things into their little heads and encroaching on that when they don't even have a concept of it, you are violating their right to privacy and branding them for life, so that later on as they grow up, you leave a scar on them that they have been violated, that their privacy has been violated. And many kids can never shake that off. It's like it gets stuck to them for life, and they never are able to escape from it. As we said before, I believe many women who are abused by family members as kids, many of them end up in prostitution and other very promiscuous lifestyles, because they have, it's as if they are scarred with that violation, and once they are violated, then they feel that brand on them their whole lives, and they can never shake it off. It's as if there's no need to be clean, there's no need to be their own integral being, because that's all been taken away. They're branded, and they can never shake that off, and then you destroy their lives. And that's what liberals are doing by sexualizing children in such a radical way. The things that they're doing in schools, teaching them things and bringing in transvestites to kids' shows just to show them how normal that is, quote-unquote, when in reality that sort of lifestyle is very uncommon and is more a product of psychological issues. People who have psychological conflicts in their hearts and minds from all of this stuff that we've been talking about. And then you start kind of spreading that those psychological problems to kids, who start thinking, oh, maybe when I tried those high heels, my mom's high heels, because I was curious how they felt, because I was wondering how she can walk on those things. Oh, that must mean I am a transvestite, and they plant that thought into the kid's mind. And as I was saying, I'm just giving a crazy example where a kid might have done something but for motivations that are completely different, and then an adult comes, a bitch or a son of a bitch, white liberal, comes and tells them, hey, you might be a transvestite, you might be a transsexual, and that's a very strong possibility. And then the little kid connects that with the moment when he kind of put on the high heels one day. He saw them there, he just wanted to try them on because he was wondering, how can a person walk on these things? And then he said, oh, I must be a transsexual, when it really was nothing at all like that, because he as a kid didn't really understand sexuality, didn't see it in sexual terms. These two shoes that looked weird and difficult to walk on. So it's very important to kind of mention all these things. And we have been saying this in the context of race, because we were saying that with race there is a fluidity that gender does not have. That in race you can decide to be adopted or adopt yourself into a race, saying, I will embrace those values, those cultural values, and then you become as a person of the other race, because you have decided to embrace those values. Each race comes with certain gifts, like genetic gifts, and those gifts create tendencies, and then people of other races can look at those tendencies and embrace them as their own, and there's like an impartation from one race to another. So there's a fluidity going on there where people get imparted these qualities. And there is a little bit of that fluidity with men and women, but not in a sexual, physical way. It's more at a higher level, as we said before, where women learn male qualities by observing men who are born with them naturally. And men can learn feminine qualities by observing women who are born with those qualities, and it can exercise them naturally. A woman can be emotional because she has the hormonal components that are more prone to emotionalism. A man doesn't have that, but he can learn how to be emotional in a proper way by observing women, and then, you know, embracing that, but without the exaggeration. The same thing with a woman. A woman can learn to be more aggressive, more with a conquering spirit, for example, but without going overboard, let's say in some, you know, when it comes to certain levels of aggressiveness that are not right. Aggressiveness is not necessarily good or bad, but sometimes it can be bad. and a woman can learn to absorb that aggressiveness from men, but without taking on bad aggressiveness as well. So there is a fluidity that can happen at the race level. At the gender level, but it's not as fluid as what happens with race. So now that we have said that, we'll just quickly go over once again how all that we've talked about would kind of get plastered into the Constitution. And the new American Constitution. And one thing would be, as we said before, that the Constitution should start with a very clear statement when it comes to race, that individuals have the same inherent value and start with the same fundamental rights regardless of race, ethnicity, or culture. And we all start with the same fundamental rights, but as a side note, it's worth mentioning, not all of us end up with the same fundamental rights. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is, for example, I can have the right to life. I'm born with it. And the right to life, as we've explained before, is the right to have freedom, to express myself, to be myself. It includes freedom of speech and freedom of religion and all these other things. And so I have this right to life. But if I then come and exercise that right to life and then start robbing people and killing people, then authority, true authority, will see that I'm violating other people's rights. If I'm stealing from them, I'm violating the right to property. And if I am killing them, I'm violating their right to life. In other words, I'm using my right to life to take away their right to life. And true authority can then come and say, okay, you are violating other people's rights, therefore we're going to put you in jail. And the moment they put you in prison, then prison is a form of death. It's a form of taking away a person's right to life, because that person is constrained to that space. And we'll have, hopefully, an audio snippet on how we have to reform the penal system in America. That is all messed up, but that's a very long parenthesis, so we'll leave it for another audio clip. But in essence, being in prison is having your right to life limited or taken away. It's a form of death. So death in the sense that your right to life is taken away in great measure, because life, as we said before, is like the other side of the coin that says liberty. So liberty is on one side of the coin and life is on the other. So if you take away a person's right to life, you're taking their liberty away. And if you're taking their liberty away, you take away their life. So that person who is in jail or in prison, has less right to life than the person who is free. But you say, oh, so are we violating that person's right to life? The answer is no. The person who's outside free, who's not committed a crime, started with the same right to life as the person who is in prison. They both started the same, but the actions of the guy who went to prison led to him having his rights reduced. So that's why it's important to emphasize when we say this in the Constitution that individuals have the same inherent value and start with the same fundamental rights. So, for example, just to say it quickly, we will have a separate audio snippet on Black America, but Black America is disproportionately more imprisoned than white people in America. There's a disproportion in terms of population of Black people in prison. That means that Black people have their right to life more limited than white people when it comes to prison. And that's not necessarily good or bad, assuming that that the legal system is working as expected, then it the reason why black people are more in prison than white people is because they have chosen to live a life that violates the rights of others more frequently, and therefore they have less right to life than white people. But it's the product of their actions, not because of their color or their skin, not because of who they are inherently or how they were, you know, how they started from birth. It's because of what they did since birth. But the taking away of those rights has to be on a level field, in the sense that everybody of the same race will be treated the same way and have their rights taken away if they are not doing what is right. So number one, individuals have the same inherent value and start with the same fundamental rights regardless of race, ethnicity, or culture. And then number two would be the statement that different races have different general attributes. It's important to mention that, to say, yes, we are all, from a rights perspective, equal, but that does not take away the fact that different races have different attributes. You know, black people have certain skills, statistically speaking, that are more prevalent than in white people. And white people have certain skills that are more prevalent than in other races. Oriental people have certain skills that are more prevalent than in other races. And certain races have certain deficiencies that are more prevalent than in other races. And it's just a fact. It's part of the genetics and part of the calling of each race. And as we've tried to explain before, there are 12 tribes. The humanity can be divided into 12 fundamental racial groups, or tribes, as I like to call them. And each tribe has a different calling, a different functionality and purpose for existing. And as such, they need different attributes. You know, it's like a quarterback in American football. He has certain attributes that a offensive lineman doesn't have, and vice versa. The quarterback has the ability to kind of throw the ball with accuracy and to kind of look at the field and know where to pass the ball without it getting intercepted and so forth. And an offensive lineman, would probably not be able to throw a complete pass even if his life depended on it, or be able to read a defense and know where the hole is, so that, you know, to know where to send the ball to get it caught and score a touchdown or whatever. But by the same token, an offensive lineman has a certain physical quality to him. He's big and strong, 350 pounds or whatever, and he can withstand the onslaught of 300-pound linemen coming at him to protect the quarterback. So the quarterback, if he was 350 pounds like the offensive lineman, would not be able to function as a quarterback. So each position has different attributes, and that those attributes create limitations and create advantages. And the same thing happens with races. Every race has certain limitations and certain advantages. And that's where the interaction between races and understanding how races, what each race does, helps to foster the dynamic of sharing, of impartation between races. If I know that a certain race has a certain quality to it, I can learn from it and get an impartation from that race and learn something that I am naturally deficient at, and so forth. And I can impart to others my qualities that might not have come naturally to someone else. And that's important to put it in the Constitution, that recognition that races have different attributes. And that helps with the question, for example, of let's look at hockey. ice hockey, a very popular sport in Canada and the U.S. and in many European countries. In North America, in the National Hockey League, I think it was a. I remember years ago, I think there might have been only one white black player in the entire league. I think there are more now. I don't follow those sports anymore, but I'm pretty sure that there are more black players now than there were before. But even if there are more now, they must be few and far between. And does that mean that the National Hockey League in North America is racist? No, the answer is no. Black people are just not as interested in ice hockey as white people. White people like cold weather for some genetic reason, and black people and other people don't like cold weather for genetic reasons. And it's not neither a good thing or a bad thing. That's just genetically how each race is built. And there are certain skills or certain there's a certain mindset in hockey that is more natural to the white man than it is to the black man, and therefore to just look at the statistics and say, hey, 90% or 95% of players are white and only 5% are minorities means that this is discrimination. It would be stupid because it violates or kind of ignores this second statement that we're making that would be in the Constitution, that different races have different general attributes. You know, it's also, for example, the same as if you think about the number of black people in computer science compared to Oriental people. The number of black people in mathematics compared to Oriental people. As you know, Oriental people have this reputation for being very good in mathematics. I'm of Oriental descent, and I studied mathematics a lot when I was a kid, and that was one of my strong subjects. I think that must have been genetic, it must have come in part from my genetics. From the Oriental side of my ancestry. So does that mean that if you do a body count of how many mathematics professors there are at universities and you see that the number of Orientals are is so much higher than black people, does that mean that there's some sort of deficiency or racism going on? The answer is no. The answer is simply no. It's not that. It's just that the Oriental race has that quality. For some odd reason, Oriental people tend to be very good with mathematics. Tend to be. That does not mean there can't be a bright, very brilliant black mathematician, for example. It doesn't mean there might not be some very dumb Chinese Chinese person who couldn't understand math, even if his life depended on it. So there might be some Chinese guy out there who's horrible with math and a black person who's brilliant with mathematics. But on a general level, it does not work that way. That's the same thing with quarterbacks in the National Football League. White people have a certain... Their life and their structure, their culture, and their genetics are geared more towards organization, towards planning and devising things. Black people don't have that as much. That's why they're not as many good black quarterbacks as there are white quarterbacks. It's not racism. It's not that the NFL is racist and doesn't want a black quarterback because that's the leadership position and they don't want black people in leadership. Or the same thing with coaching. They say, oh, there are too many white coaches. No, the thing is, white people have this thing about organizing and planning and strategizing that other races don't have. White people love meetings. White people love planning and organizing and developing goals and KPIs and OKRs and whatever you want to call them, all these things that they plan out. And black people and other people couldn't care less. You know, it's like, oh my goodness, this is a waste of time. But white people love that. And that's why they're good in positions where there's a need for a lot of planning and preparation and tactics and things like that. And we can look at basketball. The vast majority of players in the NBA are black, because the skill set required to play basketball is perfectly suited for black people. They tend to be taller and not just taller but more agile. White people can be tall, but they can be very clunky sometimes. And black people can be very very big and very agile, fast and creative in the way they play. So that will naturally lead to more black people playing basketball. Does that mean there's racism there, like reverse racism? No, it's not reverse racism. It's important that this concept, different races have different general attributes, be put into the Constitution, because it will help to prevent stupid laws that force a certain equality that does not exist. Equality in the sense of equal results that can only come from equal distribution of attributes, which is not the case. Equal in the sense of diversity, not that some people have more than others. It's just that some people have some qualities and others have others. And that's just the way it is. And the third thing that is important to mention or include in the Constitution regarding race is that it's valid to declare that people of a certain race, ethnicity, or culture develop certain patterns of behavior where some of those patterns are good and some of those are bad. In other words, it is valid to say, hey, black people tend to do this. As I've said over and over again in these audio clips, black people, unfortunately in America, have this tendency to engage in drugs much more than other races. For example, the smoking of cannabis. And as I've said over and over again, every time almost every time I feel the stench of cannabis, I turn around on the streets and I see a black man or a black woman puffing away the cannabis. And sometimes it's a Hispanic. Once every blue moon, it happens to be a white guy or a white lady. Once I saw an Oriental. That was once. But almost every time it's a black guy. I even, like, 2 days ago, I went to the pier here in Hoboken. And from a distance, as I was approaching the place where I wanted to sit down and drink my coffee, I saw from a distance this black guy with this huge afro. And when I saw him, I said, oh, black guy, huge afro, he's here to smoke cannabis. And lo and behold, I sat down, and like a minute or two after I sat down, boom, the puff, this stench of cannabis hit me from behind. Because I sat in a place where he was a little bit behind me. He was like 40, 50 yards away. But the stench was so strong that it hit me. And he was smoking, and it was just intolerable. And so I knew from the beginning that he was him being a black man with an afro, and I could see the attitude in his face, that this guy is going to be stinking up the place. This black bastard is going to stink up the place with cannabis. So that is an example of how certain cultures develop certain tendencies. And you can more or less predict certain behaviors based on race. That does not mean that every person of that race will do that thing. But it is valid to expect certain patterns, and that some of them are good and some of them are bad. And it's important to mention that in the Constitution, so that if a person comes out and says, people of a certain race have this bad habit, that will not, cannot be labeled as hate speech, because it's a statement of reality. Well, the only thing that is to be debated is whether or not the statement is true. In other words, do black people have a tendency to smoke cannabis? what does the evidence say? I live it out every single day. When I go to New York, here in Hoboken, Hoboken has a very small black population. Yet, the vast majority of times when I'm outside in Hoboken, it's a black guy smoking cannabis. Because the son of a bitch, Phil Murphy, who will burn in hell the day he dies, that little worthless Irish bastard boy, legalized the smoking of marijuana in the state of New Jersey at the time of this recording. So the evidence shows that is the reality. So what is a black person to do when I say that? When I'm outside and I start shouting, marijuana lives do not matter, is a black person to be offended by that? Or should the reaction be, okay, this guy is saying that we are puffing away and living a life of indulgence and laziness and purposelessness, smoking cannabis, disrespecting the airspace of people around us, and not doing anything with our lives. He's saying this. Is this true? And if this is true, the answer should be, okay, let's go clean our act. Let's go talk to our kids and tell them, what the hell are you doing with your lives doing this to yourselves? And you demand respect from other people, yet you do not give it. You are going around contaminating the airspace of other people with no regard for them, for their tranquility, their well-being, their state of rest. You don't care about any of that. Yet you demand to be respected by other people. You know, give it, and it shall be given unto you. If you don't give out respect, don't expect respect to be given to you. That should be the attitude that black people, responsible black people, should take. Okay, we have to clean our house, but unfortunately, we have an environment. And almost, we're getting to, even in Europe, it's even worse in a sense in America, because in Europe, I think it's been legislated a lot more. All that hate, whatever, you know, if someone says a certain thing, that's hate speech. We have that in America as well, but not as well developed or as well corrupted as in Europe. But we have to have this in the Constitution, where we have to have the freedom to declare that certain races have certain patterns, and some of those patterns are good, some of them are bad, and it's ironic that this unwillingness to recognize patterns is only done when it comes to non-white people, because when it comes to white people, it seems like, but we have no problem seeing how evil the white man is. And those stupid terms as white privilege and all this nonsense that the idiotic white liberals, ironically, have produced. All this nonsense is saying white people have a tendency to exploit other people, to take advantage of other people, to rob and steal from other people. So it's okay for white to say that there's a pattern of evil in the white race, but not about any other race. And that, to me, is an example of how philosophically inconsistent liberalism is. Forget about the details of it. It is just completely self-contradictory and inconsistent. And you, as a rational thinking human being, cannot possibly embrace something that is inherently self-contradictory. If you're intellectually honest, you have to go, there's something wrong with everything that's being said here, because we do one thing here and we do the opposite right here. It seems like we just accept something only when it's convenient for us, and when it's not convenient for us, then we suddenly forget what we are preaching all the time. So that's the third thing. And as a sub point of that third point, we can say that the act of declaring a culture inferior to another culture cannot be outlawed, even if the culture is directly tied to a race. So if someone says that a certain culture is inferior, the way I always say, the Hispanic culture is inferior. The Hispanic culture is one of the most worthless cultures on the face of the earth. That is not I'm speaking of a culture that's clearly tied to an ethnic racial group, and that declaration of inferiority should not be outlawed, because it's a declaration of patterns that have been cultivated in that culture that are evil. That's why you have, as we've said before, 15 out of the top 20 countries in the murder per capita list on Earth, of the highest murder per capita list, 15 of the top 20 countries year after year are Hispanic countries. They kill each other at an alarming rate. They are violent with each other. You know, you go to a Hispanic country, and if you're walking down the street, you better be careful what you are showing, you know, on you. If you have a fancy a smartphone, you better, you know, tuck it away. Don't show it off. Don't if you have fancy jewelry, don't show it off, because you never know when a car's going to stop and someone's going to get off the car and put a gun to your head and try to take it away from you. There's something decrepit about the culture. That's why they've always had dictators, because they're always trying to take advantage of each other and exploit each other. And it's as if, you know, they try to get away with things. They steal from each other as long as they can get away with it. And when they gain positions of power, they use it to oppress each other and destroy each other. So there's something inherently wrong. And making that statement is not a declaration of racism. It's a declaration of patterns that have been accepted and embraced. And when the Hispanic gets confronted with that, he gets outraged. Here in Hoboken, I've noticed over and over again. I remember one day I was crossing the street, and I look, and there's some sort of conflict going on. Somebody getting out of his car and arguing by getting out of his car, he was blocking traffic. And I looked at them and said, that must be a Hispanic. And I looked, and yes, it was a Hispanic who had some sort of argument with someone. I didn't even want to stick around. I couldn't have cared less what Hispanics do. Hispanics should disappear from the face of the earth, and they will be gone in 50 years, hopefully. But the thing is that, and when I say Hispanics disappear, I mean the Hispanic culture and whatever is identified as Hispanic. The concept of Hispanic will disappear and be isolated into the swamplands of hopelessness in Latin America, in Hispanic America. But the thing is, the guy was irate, and he was arguing like an idiot with someone else and blocking traffic. And I've seen that over and over again. The Hispanic is violent. I've only been attacked physically 3 times in my life. All 3 times it's been Hispanics. All 3 times. And you might say, oh, that's why he's resentful. No, because the first time that it happened to me, I was 5 years old. A young kid, I was going to I was a 4 or 5 years old. My mom had sent me to the corner store to buy some groceries. I forget what it was. She gave me the money. I was just walking down the street, down the pavement, the sidewalk to the corner store. There was a kid on the stoop. He saw me, and he must have seen that I was happy. I don't know what it was. I didn't know him. The Hispanic kid came off the stoop, and he punched me in the stomach. And then I was a kid. I didn't punch back. I didn't have that aggressiveness in me. I just turned around and went crying back to my mom. And I don't remember if my mom spoke to the neighbor or whatever happened. That was so long ago, I don't remember. But that was the first time I was physically assaulted by anyone. It was a Hispanic kid. But that was kind of like a non-issue for me. And I was a believer that the Hispanic culture, the Hispanic people had a great calling. And I believe that the Hispanics had decided to do the right thing and live out their purpose, they would have been amazing, amazing. It would have changed the world. Hispanics would have changed the world. That's how much I invested myself emotionally in the Hispanic people. And then at one point, 19 years ago, I came to the realization one Sunday that no, these people are dead. And it, after all that effort that I had put emotionally into them, I realized there's nothing worthy of them. They are done. And interestingly enough, after I decreed that sentence on them, then it's like the door opened up and then they started attacking me physically. And then two times, it's been Hispanics that have gotten out of their car to attack me physically and punch me. And I've had to confront, and I've confronted them back without punching them, because I would never back down from any son of a bitch, Hispanic or anyone. And I would confront them, and I confronted those two guys and spoke to them until they walked away. But it's never been a white guy attacking me, not even a black guy punching me. It's been Hispanics. There's something rotten in Denmark, but it's not Denmark. It's the Hispanics. There's something rotten in the Hispanics. And when it comes to crime, I can tell you the only time I've been physically mugged by anyone, where someone has kind of violently taken hold of me and taken something from me forcefully, it's been two black guys when I was 12 years old. And you could say, oh, is that why he says what he says about black people? No, I couldn't have cared less when I was a kid. I was mugged when I was 12 years old. That was in Queens, New York. I was 1 month away from being 12. I was 11.9 years old. And those two black guys robbed me. And it never became a thing with me. I was also a believer in black America, that black America, I had big dreams about them. I'd get inspired when I'd listen to Martin Luther King talking about the, you know, I have a dream and all these things, because I still see it. And I feel so much sorrow at knowing what black America lost in its stupidity, that black America could have been such a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful transformational force in America and the world. The world would have been amazed at black America, at how it blossomed and became this great group of people transforming the world. And I'm not talking about music and sports. They are very good at that. I'm talking about something deeper. And they lost it all. They gave it all away. But the only reason why I'm mentioning the mugging is just to say the statistics, the constant statistics bear out these, quote, stereotypes that people say, oh, that's racism. No, it's not racism. There's something going on here. That's what crime is committed at a disproportionate level by black people in America. It's just a fact. It's not that the cops are racist. It's not that the legal system is racist. That's just the way it is right now. And why are people afraid to say it? Because it's been labeled hate speech. And as long as no one says it, no one can change anything. And then black people continue in their state of misery. And the sad thing is that black people want to stay in that state of misery. They don't want to be told that they are doing something wrong. But regardless of whether they want to hear it or not, it shall be said to them. And I am saying it to them. And in the New American Constitution, it will be plastered that type of speech is valid. The only question is, are we saying something that is accurate? For example, if I say that Orientals are terrible at mathematics, I'd be saying something inaccurate because the opposite is true. So the statement is not wrong just because I'm saying people of a certain race tend to do something bad. The statement would be wrong because I'm saying the wrong thing. They don't have that bad quality. And it's valid to notice. So another subpoint is that it's valid to notice and react to general patterns of behavior in a race ethnicity in a probabilistic manner. And just to give you an idea of what I'm trying to say here is when I that was a couple of weeks ago, I went to the pier here in Hoboken to sit down during my lunch break. And I always look around, okay, is there any black person around? Because if there are, there's a good chance they're going to start stinking up the place. And then suddenly I saw these three or four black kids. I think there was a white kid in the group. I don't remember too well. But there were two or three black kids, young black kids. They showed up and they sat down like 30 yards from me. And when they sat down, my heart just sank because I said, oh my goodness, I'm able to breathe and relax for a short while here. And now I see these guys and they're going to start stinking up the place with cannabis, the smoke. And then I just observed them and I looked at them. And if they had noticed me looking at them, they might have thought, oh, is he looking at us because we're black? Is he racist? But yes, I was looking at them because they were black, but not because they were black, but because I was concerned that meant that there was a strong chance that they were going to start ruining my time at the pier. And then they sat down and they talked and they didn't smoke marijuana and then they left. And then I had this thought in myself, was I being racist, thinking that just because they're black, they're going to be smoking cannabis and having these negative thoughts about them? And I said to myself, no, because the pattern, I see it over and over again. Sometimes I want to give black people the benefit of the doubt, and that's more reason for them to take out the joint much faster, and to puff away even harder. So it's valid to believe that to have these expectations of certain patterns of behavior from certain races, because we as human beings, as we've said before, are built with this. We are created with this tendency to plan based on patterns. If we see the clouds gathering up in the sky, that means there's a probability of rain because we've seen the connection between clouds gathering and rain, especially if they're of a certain color. In certain regions of the country, you can kind of know this is a rain cloud as opposed to a regular, normal, gray cloud. So if you've lived in a certain part of the country or the world, you can kind of, by looking at the cloud patterns, get a sense of whether rain is coming or not. And so we are, and then, we have to watch out for the rain. I'm not going out today, or I'll put on something for the rain because I'm expecting rain. So we are created to act based on predictions of patterns that we've seen before. If you have a bunch of kids from a certain who look a certain way in your neighborhood, causing trouble all the time, if you see those kids coming towards you in the middle of the night in a dark street, you're going to act accordingly. Even if the kids are not going to do you any harm, the pattern of behavior is there, and it's valid to act on it. Should those black kids have felt offended if they had known that I was expecting them to smoke cannabis? Well, in a sense, you could say yes. As a black person, if I was them, I would feel kind of sad that I was deemed as a drug addict just because I was black. But I would ask myself, okay, is his concern valid? And if his concern is valid, then I should. As a black person, I should be the first person to speak to other black people and say, what the hell are we doing with our lives? What the hell are we doing living with, drugs? And we constantly complain about poverty and being oppressed and all this. And how can we be poor and be burning our money away in this dissolute, indulgent lifestyle? So I should be the first one to speak out instead of being offended. So the other thing is, legislators should work to attack areas of inferiority in a culture, and they should recognize that different races have different attributes that need to be taken into account, but always from a generic perspective. This is all part of point number three that we've been saying. point number three was, it's valid to declare that people of a certain race, ethnicity, or culture develop certain patterns of behavior, where some of those patterns are good and some of them are bad. So legislators should be working, and this should be in the Constitution, that legislators should be looking at areas of inferiority. For example, Amerindians have a reputation for alcoholism. There's something in their culture that promotes alcoholism. If we care about Amerindians, then as a legislator, if I have Amerindians in my district, you could say in my area or my state, a significant number of them, I would try to see what can we do legislation-wise or something to help promote anti-alcoholism amongst Amerindians. If I see crime in Black America, what can we do to legislate to fight the root of it? What is causing Black kids to go into a life of crime? And so that, but that's recognizing there's an inferiority here. Blacks are inferior in this area. Amerindians are inferior or showing weakness in this area. Or Orientals are inferior in this area, if there was some sort of criminal problem there, and so forth, and attack it that way. And recognize that as legislation is done, we have to address the differences in each race, that each race has different attributes. So because of the attributes, they need to be treated sometimes in a different way, not preferential, not being, not in terms of affirmative action, that's not what I'm talking about. But certain people need to be talked to a different way. People who are judgment-oriented need to be spoken to a certain way. People who are visionary need to be spoken to a different way. And that's one of the problems, that's why Republicans don't connect with Black people. Because to talk to Black people, you need to speak to them in a visionary way, because they are very visionary. And if you don't speak the visionary language to them, they won't hear what you have to say. If you speak from an organizational way, which is what white people do, especially Republicans all the time, you're not going to get to Black people. They're not going to listen to you. You have to speak to them a certain way. To Danish people, to people the Nordic people, you speak a different way. They understand a certain language more easily than other people. So you have to speak that language to them. And we'll talk more about this when we talk about Black America and how Republicans have failed them in so many ways. And that's not saying that Democrats have not failed them either. In fact, Democrats are the main reason for their demise. But Republicans have not done anything to help Black people either, or done very little, if anything. So now point number four that we need to mention that should be in the new American Constitution is just to be very clear that race, ethnicity, or culture does not define identity, that every individual forges his or her own identity and destiny. And that's one thing that I wish Black America could understand, that they have to stop pretending that they are dependent on the white man to be okay. If someone spoke with authority and said to them, Black America, you are the architects of your own destiny. You decide where your life goes, not whitey, you decide. If they took that attitude, then things would change, and they're not going to change. I've lost all hope for Black America collectively as a people understanding that. They've chosen not to. They threw it all away. And I believe they lost their calling in 2015, around August of 2015, 2016. I'm not too clear on the year, but I remember that day when it was very clear to me, Black America, you're done. What all that was there for you that you were going to achieve and conquer, it's gone. You idiots, you gave it up. You stupid idiots, you give it all up. And now I think there is a little bit of hope, but it's more for Black people, I would dare say, in the UK. I think the last bastion of hope of Black people anywhere on earth doing anything significant and fulfilling their calling in any shape or form. So that does not mean that black people individually in America might, you know, might not be, that does not mean they won't be able to some individuals to achieve certain great things, but it's going to be very few and far between, and not at the level at all, not anywhere near the level that it was meant to be. So the thing is, race, ethnicity, and culture does not define your identity. You are who you are, and the value that is in you is based on your decisions. You forge your destiny. You forge your identity. And that it needs to be in the Constitution to create a higher level of accountability so that we don't put in laws that kind of favor a certain race over the other and kind of give kind of excuses to a certain race for behaving a certain way, the way we have in America with black people. And then the fifth and final thing that we need, I believe, will be or should be in the new American Constitution as a fifth principle is that the two human genders have important and distinct functionalities in the human experience. And just by stating that, you're saying there are two genders, male and female, biological male, biological female, and that they have important and distinct functionalities. Important means that you can't do away with one of them. You can't suppress malehood and have a normal humanity. You can't suppress womanhood and have a normal humanity. But their roles are different. They are important, both of them, but they are different. And one of them has a certain tendency to dominate more than others genetically. And it's the male functionality, because if you let the male be himself, he's going to, in general terms, become more dominant than the woman, because the woman's role is different. The functionality is different. The woman's role is more nurturing, more protecting, more gathering, like a hen gathers, her chicks. It's that protection that the male does not have. But as they exercise their functionalities, it will look like one is more dominant than the other. But it's just part of their roles. And that does not mean that a woman cannot exercise dominance in a position, but it's not, but it's in a more virtual way. As we've said, for example, as a woman who is head of a company, she will have to exercise manly qualities in terms of being a conqueror, being a visionary, being more judgmental, so to speak, as opposed to being more of a server or an organizer. But that principle that the two human genders have important and distinct functionalities in the human experience, that should be in the Constitution. And as a sub-point of that, that legislation cannot force the suppression of one of the genders or the denial of the differences between the two. You can't force them to be the same. That's why you can't force women to play with men or men to be allowed to play with women the way, you know, we've had recently with the transsexuals, men, men who feel like women and they start playing with women and you know, dominating naturally, because the man, when he's allowed to be himself, will tend to dominate women over women because of the functionality. It's a functionality thing. It's just unavoidable. But that's unfair to women, because the reason why they play separately is because we accept women are physically less powerful than men. It's just a fact of life. And you can't force them to be the same. Because that's denying this principle. There are two human genders. They have important and distinct functionalities. And if you try to pretend like they're the same thing, or they're this massive, fluid, a nondescript sea of things where you can't distinguish one from the other, then you're denying reality, and that is and that should be against the Constitution, unconstitutional, when this fifth principle gets written into it. So in conclusion, criticism about a race, nationality, or culture should not be perceived as an attack on the person's identity. It should be evaluated and acted upon if valid. And criticism can sometimes be reflected in statistical responses. If I'm at the airport and I'm inspecting people, if I tend to inspect Arabic-looking people more than white grandmothers in wheelchairs, that is saying, hey, Arabs, you have shown a tendency to do terrorism, like in the 72 Munich Olympics, you did at 9/11, like you did here, you did there, and so forth. And that is should be a call for Arabs to say, are we doing more terrorist activities than other groups? So that's criticism can be reflected in what I would call statistical responses, and that should be valid. I believe we have spoken what we need to say more or less about race in general, and we will be talking about Black America, doing a little bit of history, and trying to get a sense of what happened with Black America in future audio snippets. Thank you very much.